From WUOT News, this is The Method, a series exploring the intersection of science and society. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Forestry in Tennessee accounts for $12 million in economic activity and nearly 40,000 jobs, but that could change in coming years as climate change alters tree habitats. WUOT's Christine Jessel reports scientists at Oak Ridge National Laboratory are working to create a map that will predict what will happen to forests as climate change progresses.
Some North American tree species have vast boundaries. Take Tennessee state tree, the tulip poplar. It ranges from Illinois to the eastern coast, from Florida's panhandle up into parts of Vermont. Other species establish small footholds. The Fraser fir, for example, grows only in the southeastern Appalachian Mountains above elevations of 3,900 feet. Jitendra Kumar is a researcher at the Climate Change Science Institute at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. His study shows how trees like the Fraser fir may fare in the years 2050 and 2100 under several possible climate change models.
If the higher elevation starts to warm, they'll try to go up, up, and eventually they will be pushed off the cliff because there is nowhere for them to go because there is a geographic discontinuity for them, and there's only so much ability for them to be able to migrate. And in the case of Fraser firs, things are not, doesn't look too bad in terms of our predictions, but there are cases where the only way for the tree species to survive will be through a human-assisted migration. And there's an entire area of research where people are considering how, which tree species you may have to actually pick up from one location and plant in another location where you know that they will be able to grow.
Kumar says these projections will help foresters decide which trees to manage. He's looking at 300 American tree species in all, predicting whether they can migrate through natural processes or if they'll need to be managed to ensure survival. It's a joint project with the U.S. Forest Service.
They have limited resources and they have to focus somewhere. So they will be able to come up with a prioritization. And they can actually look at what will happen to these tree species. And there may be a few tree species which are of special importance, especially, let's say, for economic importance. And they may be able to focus their efforts on those tree species and at least will know what we are dealing with.
Kumar says every climate model the team runs has a slightly different story to tell. The full journal article will be published later this year. For The Method, I'm Christine Jessel, WUOT News.
The University of Tennessee has launched a facility to study radiochemistry, and no, it does not involve inserting strips of litmus paper into your radio. To find out what radiochemistry really is and what we can learn from it, WUOT's Chrissy Kuiper sat down with the center's director, Howard Hall.
What is radiochemistry?
It's a field at the intersection of chemistry, nuclear engineering, and nuclear physics. Radiochemistry is the use of either nuclear materials to understand chemical processes or chemical science to understand nuclear processes. In some ways, radiochemistry was the genesis of the Manhattan Project. One of the first things that gave people the clue that nuclear material could be used for massive amounts of energy was the discovery of nuclear fission. And when fission was discovered, people didn't understand it until a series of chemists did a very good chemical separation of the products of fission and showed that it was, in fact, not some new element or some heavier element, but that the uranium that they had been bombarding had broken apart into lighter elements. And that was really the breakthrough that led people to understand fission. And, of course, from fission came the possibility of an atomic bomb, and thence the Manhattan Project.
The forensic nature of this study to figure out where a weapon came from after it was detonated. How does that work?
Let's sort of walk through the scenario.
Yeah.
Some terrorist organization or some nation state who's trying to do something and maybe finger a terrorist organization for it has a nuclear weapon. It may be crude or it may be sophisticated. We don't know at this point. They manage to sneak it into a city and they detonate it. When it detonates, the first thing, of course, that happens is that the nuclear fuel that is in that device is burned, at least partially burned. And by burned, we mean that there's a lot of fission reactions, and if it's a complex device, there may be fusion reactions going on. You get a big explosion, we kill a lot of people, and then you create a lot of fallout. Mm-hmm. The radioactive signature from that fallout is immediately derived from the materials that you started with in that device. So if we gather some of that material, if we can measure all those components, we can actually start unwinding that design by going backwards through the sort of work that we used to do in the U.S. for nuclear testing. So if you know, for example, from the debris that it had uranium fuel and it was a low efficiency device, and maybe you found some activation materials around it, maybe you were able to determine that it had a lot of iron around it, or maybe a lot of tungsten around it. By using some of the weapons design codes and in essence running them backwards, you can narrow down from that data what sort of device it was. And we can then use that information to start to understand who potentially could have done it, and equally importantly, start to quickly rule out who didn't do it.
Finally, this month marked the 10th anniversary of the biggest blackout in American history. That power failure threw 50 million people in cities from Detroit to New York into darkness during a heat wave. The blackout was a wake-up call to many energy companies that outdated power grids were increasingly prone to failure.
Today, we just want to come out and show you some of the things that we do on a day-to-day basis to try to prevent potential problems that can, if left unattended, could cause larger problems.
Tracy Flippo has an important job with the Tennessee Valley Authority, keeping the lights on. He says walking the 16,000 miles of electrical lines in the TVA system would take months, so the utility devised a better way to examine power lines for damage and try to prevent those major failures. Helicopter patrols are part of TVA's routine maintenance. A fleet of 7 helicopters can be sent out to fly alongside or hover over power lines and other electrical equipment from the air.
We're looking for vegetation, damaged wire, cracked insulators, and damaged circuits. Why would you swing the tail? Okay, you have to come to a hover and swing the tail so he can see up the right of way from his perspective.
Flights like these can spot typical problems, such as frayed cables, or more unusual ones, such as when hunters use insulators for target practice. If the pilots see a problem, like a tree leaning on a line or a damaged transformer, they can alert either local utilities or TVA's own repair crews to come out and fix the issue. Flippo says TVA has 5-9 reliability, meaning the power keeps flowing 99.999% of the time. He hopes that maintaining an eye in the sky can help keep the chances of the next great blackout as close to zero as possible. That's The Method from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.